I want to begin by asking everyone to close your eyes and encourage everyone to close their eyes. One, so we can experience this together, but two, I'm going to be closing my eyes also, and so I can't tell if you're cheating. It is the dark, the black of the early morning. And the sky is overcast, and the stars have hidden their light behind the clouds. There is no light. It is just darkness. And then slowly, the black becomes a deep blue, an orange hue is softly seen in the distance. The blue lightens. The orange brightens. Until eventually, before you, what you are looking at is a beautiful sunset. And whereas before it was utter darkness, now you are seeing the sun in all of its radiance and all of its glory. And now you can open your eyes. What we're trying to do as we begin this evening is approximate, at least in a very imperfect way, something of what the blind man was looking at. Something of his experience in John chapter 9. And again, it is an imperfect approximation. Number one, because we could picture the sunset in the first place, or the sunrise in the first place. We've seen that picture before. And so it is very easy for us to conjure up in our minds once again what that would look like. And so it's an imperfect metaphor. But at the same time, think about how as you, if you're in a situation where it is pitch dark and the stars are hidden, and then you begin to watch and to see the sunrise. It doesn't happen all at once, does it? It happens slowly. And at first, maybe you start to be able to make out some things. You can start to see motion, for the full spectrum of color is hidden to you. It is dulled. But then as the morn progresses, you begin to see more and more until ultimately you're able to see everything in vivid color. Full vibrance. And that is kind of how this story moves in John chapter 9 as the blind man comes to see Jesus. You've got to imagine when he first opened his eyes, he probably didn't see everything right away. His eyes were not adjusted. In fact, at first it was probably very blinding for him to open his eyes. But then as time progressed, he began to see more clearly. As time progressed, he began to see Jesus more clearly. And that's how it works in our lives, is it not? The light, it begins as just a deep blue, a glimmer of orange in the distance. We don't see the glory and the radiance and the fullness of Jesus when we first become Christians. That light is just dawning in our lives. But as we come to know him more and experience him more, that light brightens, and we can appreciate all the vividness, all the vibrance, the full spectrum of color that he gives to us. Here in John chapter 9, Jesus is carrying on this idea that he is the light of the world, and that's been an important theme from the very beginning of John's gospel. As John's gospel begins, he paints a picture of Jesus as the Word that was God, that was in the beginning with God, that was with God, the Word through whom all things were made, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life. And the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. Jesus is that light. That light that gives life. The light that shines with the glory of God. John goes on to say, to talk about how this light, this word, become flesh. It was as if they had seen the glory of God. They had seen the glory of the only Son of God. And then it concludes, John concludes his prologue by saying, no one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. Jesus is that light shining in a dark place, making known to us the full radiance, the full glory, the full spectrum of color and light that is the glory of God. That's what Jesus is doing for the world. And that's what Jesus is doing for this man here in John chapter 9. John is picturing Jesus as the light of the world, the answer to the world's problem of darkness, of sin, and of death. And John is telling these stories of Jesus and recounting these miracles and signs of Jesus in such a way that we will come to know him in his full vibrance, in his full glory. In such a way that when we come to know him, we will put our faith and trust in him. That we will believe that he is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. And in believing, we may have life in his name. And so as we read this story of a great sign here in John chapter 9, again, it is to the extent, it's to the purpose, with the intention, we come to have a fuller faith, a fuller knowledge, a fuller trusting and confidence in Jesus as our light, as our Savior. I hope you were able to read this story this afternoon. And I hope that as you read, several things jumped out to you about this account. First of all, the text opens John chapter 9 and verse 1. And what we should notice is that this is a continuation of what has already been going on in John chapter 8. And for that matter, what was already going on in John chapter 7. And the setting here is still the same setting. Jesus is at the Feast of Tabernacles. And on the great day of the feast, the last day, Jesus has stood up. And he's made some pretty bold and exciting proclamations. Namely, that all who thirst can come to him and drink. And that out of his heart would flow rivers of living water. And the fact that he is the light of the world that gives life to men. We've noted in previous lessons that these two ideas, these two statements, they come from the context with which Jesus finds himself in. There at the Feast of Tabernacles. This feast was a feast that celebrated, number one, the provision, the protection, the prosperity that God gave to Israel as he led them out of Egypt toward a better land. And so God provided manna for them in the wilderness. God provided water for them out of the rock on a number of occasions. God provided light in the darkness. As the pillar of fire came down and he guided them on their way in which they were to go. And so that's part of the background here. The exodus from Egypt, the remembering the time when they were nomads traveling, living in booths and tents as God provided for them. But even more generally than that, we've noted that the Feast of Tabernacles also was a reflection on God's providence in general. And so it wasn't just in remembering and commemorating the Exodus, but it also became this harvest feast where they recognized God's provision at all times. And so there were two ceremonies that the Jews in the days of Jesus and before were practicing. To celebrate, to commemorate the gifts that God had given, the provision that God had given them. Number one, there was the water pouring ceremony. And again, you remember this was the processional, the parade of priests that would go down to the pool of Siloam, and they would fill their pitchers with water. And then in that same processional, they would walk back to the temple, and before the altar, they would pour out this water as a drink offering in recognition that God had provided water for them. So too, they also had a custom where each night of the feast, they lit large oil lamps in the courts of the temple. And within the temple itself, the lampstand was lit. And it symbolized, it commemorated this idea that God provided light for them. And it is within these contexts then that Jesus stands up and says, "Come to me, all who thirst." And Jesus stands up and says, "I am the light of the world." And so that same context is still in view once we get to John chapter 9. As he passed by, he's continuing the story. But the second thing that should have struck us, just even within this first verse, is not only is this a continuation of what has been going on the past couple of chapters, but also, we meet a man in a very unique circumstance. A man who has been born blind. And why that's unique is not necessarily because he's blind. That's actually a very common thing in the ancient world. You think about our modern advances in technology and our ability to sustain life and our access to clean water. All of those things help preserve our eyesight, whereas in that time, blindness was a much more common thing. It was much more easy to get an infection that would have caused you to lose your eyesight, either temporarily or permanently. But this is a special occasion. Because we know already, just from verse 1, that Jesus is going to reverse this situation. We know that. Why that is important is because there are relatively few times, even when you think about the miracles, the great acts, the great works that God did within the Old Testament, there is one occasion, kind of, where somebody is blind and then sees. And even within the rabbinic literature and the other extra-biblical Jewish literature, as they're reflecting on this malady of blindness, there are very few cases that they record where that situation is reversed. And so people being healed from their blindness, that is a very rare thing, biblically speaking, and even extra-biblically speaking. That is something that is not heard of. But then you jump into the Synoptic Gospels, and that's what Jesus is doing all the time. Jesus, at least in some way, his ministry can be characterized by bringing those who are in darkness, those who are blind, out of that blindness, bringing light into their life. And so what is a very rare occurrence outside of Jesus becomes a very usual, a very common occurrence in Jesus. But even still, here Jesus heals a man that has been born blind. And so that is unique. And in fact, that uniqueness is going to be something that is referenced by the blind man later on in the chapter. It begins with a question. As they're walking by, as they see this blind man, his disciples probably somewhat innocently ask him, "Rabbi, who sinned, that this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And it was a common understanding, from the Jews in Jesus' day that sin and suffering were integrally related. And not even just in the general sense in which we would probably talk about the relation of sin and suffering, that all suffering, at least at its root, is the result of sin and the curse and the fall and all that goes along with that. But they even went a step further, and that was to say that if you suffered, it was because you had sinned in some way, that you had brought it upon yourself. Because, of course, if God is the God of all the good gifts and all the good things, He would only bring something bad upon you, they reasoned, if you had done something worthy or deserving of that. And so this was a common understanding with the Jews at the time, and Jesus disabuses them of this. It wasn't that this man had sinned. It wasn't that his parents had sinned. It's not that sin is always necessarily the result, or rather suffering is always necessarily a result of sin. Remember, that was the problem with Job's friends. That was their misunderstanding. Well, Job, you must have done something awful to have had happened to you what happened to you. That's not to say that sin is never the cause of suffering. Certainly, we know even experientially that it is. But Jesus says it's not that this man sinned or that his parents sinned. And Jesus actually does not give us an answer here for why this man was born blind. He doesn't address that question. Our English translations may betray that idea a little bit, especially the New International Version, at least on this point. It adds, "This happened," those words which are not in the text, "that the works of God might be displayed in him." And I don't think what is being said here is that this man is who he is, has experienced what he has experienced, has been put in this position, all for the sake that God's glory might be worked out in him. Well, on the one hand, this is a pretty fine opportunity for the glory of God to be displayed. On the other hand, I don't know, at least in my thinking, that picture of God, that he would put somebody in this particular circumstance and allow them to suffer in this way, fits the biblical picture that we have of God. You may decide differently on that. But it does not necessarily have to read in this way that, well, it's not that this man sinned or that his parents sinned, but it's because God is going to display his glory in him or his works in him. It simply could just be saying, that's not the reason, but here's what's going to happen. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what is going to be accomplished. This is an opportunity now for God's glory, for his works to be displayed. And we need to talk about that a little bit, this idea of God's works being displayed, the idea of God's glory being displayed. The signs, and that word should be indicative to us, it should be helpful for us. The signs were not ends in and of themselves. And John goes out of his way to make that point. His favorite word in describing the miracles of Jesus, not wonders, not works typically, but it is signs, is how he often refers to them. And he does that intentionally because he's trying not just to inspire awe in people, as maybe the Gospel of Mark is trying to do in some ways, but he is trying to point to a reality that the sign points to. If I can borrow from what I find to be a rather humorous scenario that Tom Hamilton, Olivia's father-in-law, paints, is it's like going to a Walmart and everybody is just gathered around the Walmart sign and just, oh, how wonderful is this sign? It's just such a glorious sign. And so they never go in to see all of the glories that is Walmart because they're outside looking at the sign. They don't understand that the sign points to the actual thing. Now, I go into Walmart, but it's not necessarily to see the glories of Walmart. I think that speaks of Walmart in too high of a light. I go into Walmart to marvel at other things, namely people, and their low rollback prices. But anyways, you see the ridiculousness of that? Looking at something as if it were the real thing, and yet it's the thing that's being pointed to, or it's pointing to the thing. Probably could have said that in a clearer way. Maybe there's a sign for that or something. Jesus is going to do something with this man. He's going to do something extraordinary with this man. But what we cannot do, what John does not intend for us to do, what this man himself does not do, is get caught up in the work, in the sign, in the wonder, in the miracle. but he recognizes the thing to which it points. And so God's works are going to be displayed in this man. And Jesus goes on to talk about the fact that he must work, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. What Jesus, I think, is saying here, as he is adapting this proverb, if you don't work at nighttime, you work during the day when you have light, is my time here is limited. And I've got to be doing the work that I was sent to do now. And here is an occasion for me to do that work. And so having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And John gives us the translation there, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Maybe another thing that struck you as you read this. Why did Jesus use spit to cleanse this man? Some have suggested, and there's probably some validity to this, that in antiquity, that saliva was thought to have healing properties. And that may be what's going on here. But it also may be Jesus is doing something that is kind of silly. Jesus is doing something that maybe the man wouldn't expect, or that we wouldn't expect, or that those around him seeing this wouldn't expect. I'm thinking particularly back to the story of Naaman and Elisha. Remember where Naaman has come to Elisha to be healed of his leprosy, and Elisha commands him to go and to dip in the River Jordan, and Naaman is taken aback by that, and there's better waters, there's better rivers for me to go dip in, right? Why that dirty, mucky, nasty river? And ultimately his servants have to convince him, no, you need to listen to his word because he is the prophet of God. And what he says is going to happen. And so, ultimately, it is a question of whether or not he will put his faith in God. Maybe that's what's going on here. Or maybe, at least in line with that, we're to see, we're to understand the offense of spitting on someone. Jesus does this on another occasion as well. And it points the offense, the greater offense of the cross. Maybe that's what's going on here. But he tells the man to go wash in the pool of Siloam. And John gives us the translation. It means sent. Now why does John feel the need to translate that word for us? Well, throughout the book of John, Jesus is the one who's been established. He is the one who has been sent from God. He's the messenger from God who comes to reveal the glory of God, who does the works of God, who speaks as God speaks. He is the one sent from God. And maybe it is what is being played off of here, what our minds are to go to, is Isaiah chapter 8, where the pool of Shiloh, or Shiloah, or Siloam, which means sent, is rejected by Israel. And they go to other waters. And so here too, the Israelites, the Jews in Jesus' day, they are rejecting the one who has been sent from God in preference to whatever other cisterns it is that they desire. So he went and he washed and he came back seeing. And when he comes back, Jesus is not there. For the majority of this story, Jesus is not in the purview. And I think that should indicate something to us. What we are seeing in this story, as this man is being questioned, first by the neighbors, then by the Pharisees, then as his parents are questioned, then as the man is questioned once again, We're seeing this man's faith as it grows. And as he comes to a fuller realization, a fuller proclamation of who Jesus is. Because when he is first asked, who is it that healed you? And how is it that you have your sight? He said, it was the man who is called Jesus. He anointed my eyes. When they asked where he was, he said he didn't know. And then later on, as he is being questioned by the Pharisees, and they ask him, who do you think he is? And he comes to the realization that he must be a prophet. Because as the Pharisees are saying, well, this man can't have done these things because he is a sinner. Part of their bias against Jesus, their rejection of Jesus. This man begins to reason and he says, well, how can a sinner do such signs? And other people are reasoning these along these lines as well. And so the man comes to say he is a prophet. And then later on, when he comes back before the Pharisees and he is questioned by them a second time, and they ask him, they say, give glory to God, tell the truth. Who is it that healed you? We know that Jesus is a sinner. And the man says in verse 25, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. And they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes. And then notice verse 30. The man answered, why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could not do anything. And so his understanding of Jesus, his proclamation, his faith in Jesus grows from just the man who they call Jesus to a prophet to the one who is from God, even the Christ, the Messiah. And then by the end of the story, the man has recognized Jesus not only as just a man named Jesus, not only as a prophet, not only as one sent from God, but also as the Son of Man. And he calls him Lord, and he bows down, and he begins to worship him. And so there is a progression in the sight of this blind man. It starts out dimmer, gets brighter, clearer, as the story goes on. And so that's one point we're going to come back to. But another thing I want us to see here and something that should be very obvious, this is not a story about physical blindness. Yes, Jesus heals the man's blindness. He gives light to his eyes physically. But this is meant to point to a greater reality. Again, that was the sign. The reality is that Jesus can take us out of spiritual darkness and bring us in to light. And so that's exactly what we see happening with this man. It's exactly what the man recognizes. And that's exactly where the conversation ends. So we are brought out of a state of spiritual blindness by Jesus. He is the light in that way. other feature from this text that we would do well to pay attention to. That section there in 18 through 23, when the people don't believe that this is really the man, and so what do? They go and they get his parents and they say, "Hey, is this your son? Because this guy was blind, now he's seeing, and I don't know what to make of that." And they say, "Yeah, this is him, but I don't know where he got these things. I don't know how he's seeing now." And it's not like they didn't have a conversation about this, right? I remember being off in college, and I didn't call my mom probably as much as I should have. And I didn't, even with the big things, I didn't always tell her right away. Like, there were several hospital visits I made when I was in college, mostly because of my own stupidity. And I remember there was one time, like, I had been in the hospital, and then my mom found out about it. I think it was on Facebook, maybe. And so she calls me, and she's like, "This is a big thing. Why didn't you tell me about this? That's not what's going on here. This man's been blind from birth. He told his parents." It's not that they're just ignorant about this, but John reveals to us the real reason that they claim ignorance in this regard. It's because they feared the Jews. And the Jews, we need to understand, we probably should understand, as being the religious leaders here. The religious leaders, the Jews, they had already agreed, verse 22, that if anyone should confess that Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Even the parents recognized that if they were to say that Jesus healed this man, our son, that was a claim that Jesus is the Christ. Because again, remember, blindness is something that is just not, you're just not cured of, biblically speaking. It did not happen. And if it did, it was very rare. But the one who does heal from blindness, the one who does give light to the eyes, was the Messiah. The one who was spoken about in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, about those dwelling and Naphtali and Zebulun and the Galilee beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. On them a light has shone. Later on in the book of Isaiah, Jesus, or the idyllic servant, is the one who's going to bring people, and we talked about this a little bit this morning, who's going to bring people out of darkness and into light, out of blindness and into seeing, out of deafness and into hearing. Both Jews and Christians understood those texts to be applied, properly applied, fully applied to Jesus, to the Christ, the Messiah. And so for the parents to say, "Well, Jesus healed this man," was the same as saying Jesus is the Christ. And that's something they didn't want to say because they were not willing to be put out of the synagogue for what they knew to be true. And that's another theme in the Gospel of John that we've already noted. That there are people in John who believe, but their faith is spurious. It is not whole, it is not full. And so in John chapter 2, there at the end, it talks about how many people believed in Jesus because of the signs that he did, but Jesus, for his own part, he did not entrust himself to them because he knew what was in man. And then what is the very next story that follows after that? It's Nicodemus who comes to Jesus at night, professing that he's a great teacher come from God, but again, he comes at night. And then there are those in chapter 7 that we read about a couple of lessons ago who are unwilling to speak up or speak openly about Jesus for fear of the Jews. There's these parents here in John chapter 9. There are even the Pharisees, some of the religious leaders in John chapter 12 and verse 22, who believe in Jesus, but because they fear being put out of the synagogue themselves, do not act on that faith. And so in the Gospel of John, we've got these people who have this spurious faith in Jesus. And that's to be contrasted with these other surprising individuals and peoples who do believe in Jesus. People like the Samaritan woman at the well, who after discussion with Jesus goes off and proclaims that Jesus is the Christ. And then the Samaritans themselves, after their own discussions with Jesus, understand that he is the Savior of the world. This blind man. And that's the real irony to see here in John chapter 9. That a man who is blind sees better than those who have eyes to see. That those who have been able to see all of their life, those who have had the opportunity to sit and to study the scriptures, they can't see Jesus. But this man who professes to know nothing or to know little several times throughout John 9, he is the one who's able to truly, to fully see. The Gentiles who come to Jesus in John chapter 12 and verse 20, seeking to find him, to know him, again in contrast to the Jews who refuse to believe in Jesus. One thing that this text is doing, I think, it's challenging us in our faith. What type of faith do we have? Really, that's what the whole Gospel of John is doing. It's challenging us in our faith, and it's attempting to strengthen our faith. Are we going to be people who truly believe, truly put our trust and our faith in Jesus? Or are we people who blatantly reject him, as the religious leaders do? Or are we people who, yes, we believe that Jesus is who he says he is, but we're not willing to act on that faith, as many of the people of spurious faith do in the Gospel of John? Where is our faith? How is our faith? As readers, we are called to react to this story, I think, in three ways, on three planes. Number one, we are, as we see all of the evidence and we see all the argumentation as this man stands up to defend Jesus, even as he is coming to a deeper and greater reality of who Jesus is in his own mind, we're called to come to grips and to answer, do I believe that Jesus healed this man? Amidst all of the naysayers and claims otherwise, do I believe that Jesus healed this man? But taking it a step further than that, a second plane on which we are to react and respond to this text is not only do we believe in the historical fact, did something happen, but do we put our faith in the person who caused it to happen? And so Jesus asks the man in verse 35, not do you believe that I healed you? What a ridiculous question that would be. But do you believe in the Son of Man? Do you trust in him? He answered, sir, who is it? Or who is he that I may believe in him? And Jesus said, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. And the man says, Lord, I believe. And he falls to worship Jesus. Do I believe that Jesus healed this man? And if so, do I believe in the greater spiritual reality to which this points? That Jesus is the light of the world. That Jesus is able to heal me of spiritual blindness. Do I believe, do I trust in Jesus? Believe in the Son of Man. Sam and I were having a conversation just recently where Sam helped me in seeing this idea that it's not just the facts of, say, the resurrection that we believe in, but it's the person to whom the resurrection points, it's the reality to whom the resurrection points. It's to God, it's to Jesus, it's to the power that he has to raise us from the dead. To give us light and life. And so that pushes us on to the third plane in which we are to react with this story. And that is, what does this belief, this trust that I have in Jesus, What does it cause me to do? What does it cause me to do? You see, again, many people had an understanding, a knowledge of who Jesus is or was. And yet, they were unwilling to act on that. And yet this man, even after he knows that the Jews have made this decree, the religious leaders have made this decree, that anyone who believes in Jesus and who professes that Jesus is the Christ is going to be put out of the synagogue, he stands up and he defends him. Fearlessly. Not fearing. Not worrying. He was going to be cast out. That he was going to be rejected. Because he had seen the light. And he knew that he had seen the light. And he could not escape the reality that he had seen the light. And as that sunset is in your mind, you cannot deny that it is there. So he could not deny the reality of who Jesus was. And his faith, his trust in this man who had healed him. It caused him to go to great lengths to defend him. Getting back to this idea of the fact of the resurrection. The fact of the resurrection, the fact that God raised Jesus from the dead, should cause us to put our faith in God. That he is a God who can do that. He is a God who will do that. He is a God who has promised that he will do that for us. And so, maybe in a couple of ways that's relevant for us. Do I believe that God can take this life that in its deadness, in its sin, and its darkness can bring life and light into that life? Do I believe that if I will just submit my life to him, do I trust that if I will just come to him, he can begin to conquer the darkness in my life and bring light into it? Do I believe that? I trust in him. Maybe another way we could ask that question is, would you die for your faith? Not only the metaphorical sense that we're talking about, when we die to the old self and are raised to walk in newness of life, but like this man who feared not what would happen to him or what people would do or what people would say. Do we have that same sort of trust? Because we serve a God who is faithful. We serve a God who is light, a God who is life, who has the power over death. And so even if it means isolation or imprisonment or loss or even martyrdom, our faith in God causes us, based on the historical reality of the resurrection, causes us to live our lives unafraid before him. And here's a harrowing question. Coming back to this discussion that Jesus has with the Pharisees, and this idea of spiritual blindness. The Pharisees ask Jesus a question. They say, are we also blind? And their expectation is for Jesus to answer, well, no, you're not blind. Our expectation as we read this is what? For Jesus to say, yes, you are blind. But Jesus answers in neither of those ways. Instead, he says, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. The people who think that they see, that say that they see. They cannot come to the light. They have rejected the light. And it is in that rejection that they find their condemnation. There in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16 we know well, for God so loved the world that he sent his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. We know that well, but then going on, what does the text say? But that Jesus was not sent by God into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. So Jesus' purpose was not to come and to condemn, but it was to save. And whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And this is the judgment, that light has come into the world. And people love the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light, and does not come to the light, lest his work should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. Jesus did not come for the purpose of condemnation. Jesus did not come for the purpose of judgment, and yet people were condemned, and people were judged. When they saw that light worked in two ways. It worked to bring light, to bring opening of the eyes to those who were blind. But for those who thought they saw, those who thought they figured it out, those who thought they didn't need any help, those who claim we are Abraham's children, we have never been slaves to anyone. Those who thought they had no need for Jesus were content with where they are, wrote him off because they thought they saw. And the reality is, if any of us are going to come to Jesus and have the light and the life that he gives, we must first recognize the darkness in which we are in. Right? That's the first step. Or the first couple of steps in all the 12-step programs, right? You have to recognize, you have to admit that you are powerless in your situation, that you can do nothing about your situation. We too first have to come to the understanding that we are blind, that we are in darkness before we are ever going to see. And so again, the harrowing question is, in what ways am I in darkness? In what ways do I need the opening of the eyes? What things might I know? What things might I trust in that keep me from coming to and seeing and appreciating the light of the world? Jesus came to bring us out of darkness and into light. To quench our thirst. To provide for us everything that we need. And on the Feast of Tabernacles, as they are recognizing that God is the one who provided them water and food and light and all the necessities that they needed to sustain them, Jesus stands up on that occasion. He says, I am the answer. I am the fulfillment. I am what you're looking for. And he is what we're looking for this evening. At least I hope he is. He is the one who has the answer to our problems, to bring us out of lines. Not just so that we can bask in this light, as we talked about this morning, but so that we can become light ourselves and reflect into the world. Will you come to Jesus? Will you allow him to bring you out of the darkness that you're in and into his marvelous light? Maybe you're here this evening and you're a Christian, you're a child of God, but you have become blinded once again. I hope that you will recognize in what areas, I hope that we will all recognize whatever areas in which we need light to come into. Do you have any need this evening? Will you come to Jesus for the light that he offers? If you have any need, we can help you in any way. We ask him for it now as we stand, as we sit.